Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your home for deer hunting news, stories, and strategies. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon. This is episode number 188. And today on the show, we're joined by Whitetail Properties land specialist and renowned deer hunter, Gabe Adair. And we're chatting with him about how he killed his biggest buck ever this year and his tactics for late season hunting. All right, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by Sitka Gear. And today, we've got a great show for you, as we're going to be joined here shortly by Gabe Adair. And Gabe is a land specialist for Whitetail Properties, and he's been a longtime member of that team if you follow their TV show or just the Whitetail Properties, you know, real estate and all that kind of stuff. You've likely seen his name around a lot. Because on top of all that, he's just one of the most consistent and renowned big buck killers out there in the country. So coming up here shortly, we're going to chat with him a bit about his 2017 season so far, how he killed his biggest buck to date. And spoiler alert, it is a 200-plus inch buck, and it's like 200 and a lot plus. So we're going to dive into that and spend a lot of time talking about his tactics and philosophies for hunting the late season. So we're going to talk about what's coming up here in the coming weeks, but that's our agenda. But before we do that, I'm very pleased to say that we are back this week with our pregame show featuring my good buddy, the nine-fingered, big bearded, hammer dropping Dan Johnson. How are you, man?
I'm good, but you set me up for failure. Every time you throw one of those intros out, it's like whenever people see a picture of me, they just look at me and like, oh, that guy looks like a huge pussy. He's big, all right.
Oh, it's been too long since we got to chat together here.
I know, man. Just crazy.
Crazy schedules.
Yeah, nuts lately. I apologize. And it's not really like just – you've been doing on a crazy schedule and I've been on a crazy schedule. It's just this time of year, man, it's crazy.
Yeah. It's a challenge to line everything up between us and guests and hunting and other things. And, man, I don't know about, well, I think I know, but I've been on a little break from hunting just until today. I finally hunted for the first time in 10 days. But how about you? Have you been in the woods? I think you have been in the woods since we talked last.
Yeah, man. What was it? Last Sunday or the Sunday before last? It would have been two Sundays ago. Good, Ben Harshine from Huntera Maps, man. He's a good friend of mine, and he invited me out to his farm, and we shared a tree together, and we both had our bows with us, and we were going to try to double up on some does, and he gave me the first shot, and long story short, I laid a doe down that night, and it was just, I tell you what, there's something about that scenario where you're sharing a tree with a friend, and it's like, all we did was laugh, right? I mean, that's literally all we did, and just cut jokes. And, you know, finally we saw some deer, and these deer worked their way down, and I ended up taking one of them, and he was at full draw at one of them, and it was kind of behind a limb, and he couldn't make the shot because he didn't want to, you know, push the shot. And it was just fun. And I think that's something that, you know, it's a different kind of fun when you're not focused on, you know, chasing a buck. And it just, I don't know, it just kind of reinvigorates the soul, if that makes sense.
Oh, it definitely does. I love, as much as I like chasing, you know, big mature bucks, one of my favorite parts of the hunting season every year is either I filled my buck tags, or I've kind of said, all right, it's just time to fill the freezer. Whenever I change my goal from trying to kill a buck to it's time to kill a doe, like those doe hunts are just so much fun. Cause it's going to be a target rich environment, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
And then to your point, I 100% agree when it comes to hunting with a buddy.
Yeah.
That's always a lot of fun. I haven't got to do that this season. Just because of the craziness of what I've been up to lately. But, man, I'm glad it went well that you got deer on the ground.
Right. Now, it wouldn't be a podcast if I didn't talk about my kids for a second. and I just have to tell this story because it made me laugh and kind of cry at the same time. And I'll tell you why it made me cry.
Happy tears or sad tears?
Well, sad tears. But let me explain. You'll get it.
Okay.
So the other day, it was actually Tuesday, because instead of recording our podcast at the regular time, I was outside playing with my daughter. And I said, Ava, how was preschool today? And, you know, just like a typical kid, she's like, oh, it was okay. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what did you learn? And she walks over to me and she punches me right in the balls. And I'm just like, what? Where did that come from? Where did that come from? Just straight up, straight punch right in the nards. And
oh my god!
And I was just like, why did you do that? Well, because I like preschool, Dad. And I'm just like, what are you learning at preschool?
Did she have an explanation?
No, because anymore? She's four, and kids that are that age don't have explanations for the actions that they do.
I guess so. So how do you handle that? What's the teaching moment post nut punch from your daughter?
Right, baby. Like, I wanted to throw her in timeout. Honestly, I wanted to spank her.
Yeah,
but I just grabbed her by her shoulder and I said, "Why did you do that?" And she looked at me with these big, beautiful eyes, and she's like, I like preschool, Dad. I think it was because we were kind of roughhousing a little bit. You know, we were chasing each other in the yard and, you know, tapping each other. And I don't know. But it was kind of funny. And then later that night, my son drank an entire squeeze bottle of concentrate juice mix. Oh. You know, those little squeeze bottles?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
You should have seen him. I walked.
What did
the
his
kitchen.
Face look like?
Oh, it looked like he had a melted popsicle all over his face. And then I didn't have to change the next diaper, but because he's still in diapers, but it was red.
Oh, I bet. Ugh.
So Dude. That's kind of what I've been doing now that the bow season's over for me. That's what I do when I tag out.
Kids. Wow.
But dude, it sounds like you had a like a quick trip across North America this week?
Yeah. You know, since we last chatted, you probably didn't hear our podcast that I did with Furter. I'm sure you didn't, because you got better things to do than listen to me talk.
No, I listened to a little bit of it.
Okay, well, we were giving you some crap. But yeah, so Furter was on, and I told him about my latest exploits with Holyfield. But long story short, since you and me chatted last, I did have a handful more encounters with him, hunted up till opening day of gun season in Michigan, and then after that, you know, went up north for a few days, and then since the 19th of November, I've stopped hunting, and just had to get back to spending some time with my wife and family and doing some things for Thanksgiving with my family and her family, and just, you know... taking care of stuff. Yeah, important real world responsibilities. Yep. So did all that, but then yeah, just a couple days ago, I flew out to Seattle, Washington, to do some stuff with Steve Rinella and those guys. Did a podcast, and we went squid jigging, which was pretty cool. Yeah. So
what does squid jigging entail?
Yeah, so basically it entails going to a pier in downtown Seattle and standing on the edge of that pier with a fishing rod and a jig on the end of it. Basically imagine like it almost looks like a bobber. Like imagine like those plastic bobbers, like the long bobbers. But instead of that being a bobber, it's a weighted jig with a bunch of hooks all along the bottom of it. Like, have you ever seen those hummingbird feeders that are kind of like a teardrop shape, and then there's that tray on the bottom?
Yep.
Imagine that shape. That's the shape of the lure, but instead of that tray on the bottom, those are all hooks sticking up.
Okay.
And then you just drop your line over down the pier, and you shine this huge light down into the water, which I guess attracts these squid. And then you drop this jig down to the bottom, and then you just jig it up and down. You know, bob it up and down, and let it set, then up and down, and these squid attack it. And
that is awesome.
You bring it right on in. So there's four or five. I guess there was four of us for a period, and then a fifth joined, and then Steve's son was there, and we caught probably, I don't know, maybe 100 squid or somewhere in that ballpark. So that's pretty cool. It was really cool.
I'll tell you what, the Puget Sound up there is absolutely gorgeous country.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That Pacific Northwest area is super cool. I didn't have very much time. I wish I could have spent some more time out there enjoying the mountains and the sound and all that, but it was nice to get a really quick little trip in there and brought home a bunch of squid. So calamari is on the menu.
You got a recipe?
I haven't picked out a recipe yet. I just was, they were telling me it could be pretty good grilled or just fried up, calamari style. So I think we'll be trying a couple different things with. I brought quite a lot home. So we're just going to try some different things and see how it goes. So yeah, man, that was it was a good quick trip. It was there for, I flew in there one day and flew home the next day. And then I got back from that last night. And then this morning I drove down to Ohio. And I'm going to hunt here for 3 or 4 days, the last few days of their firearm season here.
Oh, cool.
So
anything tonight? Anything tonight?
I did not. I didn't get much of a hunt in though. I got a late start, a little bit of late start, maybe a half hour late start this morning. And then, our podcast guest that I recorded that interview earlier today, that kind of had some timing issues with that. So I got a later start on that than was hoping. So I arrived at the property like a half hour to 45 minutes later than I wanted to. And then I was getting ready and I was all set, about ready to head out. And then the landowner showed up. So I stopped to chit chat with the landowner for a couple minutes, and that went a little longer than I was hoping. So already I'm like, oh geez, I am not going to get much time or nearly as much time as I wanted. And then we say goodbye and I'm about to walk, out of the gate and into the cornfield. And then I hear the landowner start like kind of hollering, like something bad has happened.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I could just keep walking and go hunt, but no, I had to turn around and see what was going on. So I went back, and long story short, he had locked his keys in his vehicle.
Oh.
And this is an older gentleman, so I just knew he was gonna need some help. So ended up calling and finding a tow truck company in the area that could come and get the keys out. And I called around different people that might be able to help us find some spare keys around the house, but no one knew where one was, and he didn't know. And so I ended up calling a tow truck company and then waited with him for like 45 minutes until they got there to help him out. So the result of that was that instead of having like a 3-hour hunt or 4-hour hunt that I thought I was going to have, instead I had, by the time all this was done, I had like 45 minutes till dark. So I just snuck out to the edge of the cornfield and sat in the ground in some brush just to see if I could see anything. And I did not see anything. So disappointing night, but that was all right. Had to, had to help out. I certainly appreciate this landowner allowing me to hunt there. So the least I could do was help out someone that needed a hand. And hopefully better things to come the next 3 days.
Did you at least check trail cameras while you were out there?
Well, I was planning on it, but because of the fact I wasn't able to get into the core of the property like I planned on, I just was able to pull one camera that was, you know, easily accessible. So got one card out, and there's three more cards that I'm going to be able to check tomorrow. So
here's a question.
Yeah.
What happened to that property? Because what was it? I don't know. Last year may not have been as good, but the previous years, there was just, it was loaded with giants.
Yeah, man, it has been going downhill. If I had to put a finger on it, my best guess is that it's been increased pressure. I think one thing for sure is that one of our neighbors, the first 3 years, nobody hunted that property. Nobody was allowed to hunt it. And now this year and last year, it got leased. So there are people hunting our neighbor now that I think in the past that served as a sanctuary. And there was a lot of deer in and around that area that were coming onto our farm, and we were taking advantage of that. Now that's not happening. And then also I saw maybe there's more pressure on the other side, because today when I was getting ready, I saw two hunters heading into the other neighbor, and I've never seen hunters there ever before either. So if I had to guess, that's what I would say. I just think there's more people hunting around, pushing in on all the sides of it. We're just not getting the bucks like we were getting on camera in the past. It never was a property that I saw a lot of deer. It was always pretty low deer numbers, but you knew that there, you know, if you put in enough time and hunted it smart, the few deer you saw, a really good buck could be in that group. Now, you know, Josh was, you know, we've seen one nice buck. You know, I passed on him twice, and then Josh killed him. So that was awesome. But hopefully there's at least one more that will show up. I just don't know. I don't know. There's, you know, there's a chance. There's last time when I was down here, you know, that trip when Josh killed his, that was like November 9th or 10th that he killed. He killed his buck the day after you and me recorded that podcast together.
Yep.
So when we checked cameras on that trip, there's this one buck that there's one like homebody buck that has been showing up in daylight, and the one like mature buck that's been consistently on camera. And when I say consistent, it's not like he's there every day, but you know, a couple times a week or something, and some in daylight. And he's a really nice buck. I mean, he's probably definitely a 5 year old, big body, big framed, probably 150 ish something, 9-pointer I think he is. Maybe he's a 10-pointer, but really cool deer that we've had on the property for 2 years now. So my hopes, I'm kind of banking on and hoping that he's still around. And if he is, you know, maybe we'll get a crack at him over this next month. So I'm going to hunt him here these next few days during gun season, and then go home and focus on Holyfield with a big cold front that's coming through. And then, you know, as my schedule dictates, try to get back out here again if I can't get it done on this trip. So, man, that's the latest.
Holyfield showing up on camera in the past couple days?
No, but I haven't checked anything. My cell cameras don't work. None of my cell cameras work anymore. It's a very frustrating situation. So I have two cell cameras that are just sitting out there not doing anything for me. So
that sucks.
Yeah. So last time I checked cameras in person was like November 20th or something like that. So I haven't been out in like 10 days. So when I get home from Ohio, I'll be checking those out, and hopefully we'll get an answer on Holyfield. The one piece of good news I do have is that I did do a drive-by actually this morning just before I left for Ohio, and I saw the really nice 3-year-old that I've been wanting to survive this year to make it to next year, that buck I'm calling Survivor. So he is alive and well as of this morning, and today is the last day of gun season in Michigan. So if he made it through tonight, he made it through the worst of it.
Awesome.
So it would be really nice to know there's a 4-year-old that hopefully can make it to next year, or that there could potentially be a 4-year-old for next year. So fingers crossed.
Hell yeah.
So that's my story.
Cool, man. Yeah. I don't know what my late season plan is going to be. I think I'm going to be able to get out a handful of times. Nice. I don't have any trail cameras out, so it's just going to be, you know, cause I've had a problem with theft lately out on the main farm, but, you know, and also on my buddy's farm, but these pictures were during the rut. There are some good bucks running around there. Nobody hunts his little piece. So hopefully it turns into a sanctuary during gun season. And then the neighbor across the creek, he has standing food plots and then doesn't hunt the late season. So hopefully, on my buddy's farm, I might be able to run into something. And then on, my main farm, if I do go down and hunt, it's just going to be a wing it, you know, hopefully there's some snow. I can find some tracks or something to set up on, but you know, late season is late season. It can be a real struggle or it can be awesome if you find the food.
Yeah. To something you mentioned there, I sure hope we get some snow and some good late season weather. Cause right now, at least it's not real promising. It's been like 40s and 50s and not what you want. So,
right. Absolutely.
But next week, Wednesday, we've got like a big 20-degree temperature drop in Michigan. So hoping to take advantage of that.
I don't think it rained but one time the entire month of November here in Iowa. Really? So it's pretty dry out there right now.
Oh man. It was the exact opposite of that where I was. I felt like every single day I was hunting, it was raining.
Yeah.
It's been brutal. But
is North Dakota a scratch then for this year?
It's looking like it. Yeah. The only way that could change is if I kill Holyfield next week, then there's still a small chance I could try to mount a late season trip to North Dakota, but it's increasingly looking like that's a scratch, which is disappointing. But you know, I put all my eggs in the basket of Holyfield, and it just limited things. And
hey, that's the risk you take when you hunt one deer, man.
Yeah, it is. And we'll see if I can make it all worth it, or if not, I certainly learned something.
That's right.
So. Well, I think this is a good spot to wrap things up. Let's plan on talking again next week, Mr. Johnson, and I'll have some updates for my hunts, and maybe we should go get Gabe Dare on here with us. But first, let's take a quick second to thank our partners at Sitka Gear.
For this week's Sitka story, we're joined by Jake Terry, who tells us about a Nebraska public land hunt where his turkey was well earned.
So this spring I headed to Nebraska, to go out to Western Nebraska to hunt some public land, kind of run and gun style hunting. Got there and it wasn't near as easy as I thought. Had to, you know, I was walking up to 5 miles a day trying to find birds, on the fourth day, and was going to be one of the final days of my hunt. Had a rainy morning, but had finally found some birds the night before. Had to sit a couple hours in the rain, but once the rain cleared, was able to call in a couple of longbeards, from the ground, no blind, with archery equipment, shot a bird at 25 yards, ended up being a really nice bird and kind of the end to a long drawn out hunt, that I think I probably lost 10 pounds that week, in those 4 days because I walked so many miles, but great hunt.
On Jake's hunt, he was wearing Sitka's subalpine pattern. If you'd like to create a Sitka story of your own, or to learn more about Sitka's technical hunting apparel, visit sitkagear.com.
All right, with us on the line now is Gabe Adair. Welcome to the show, Gabe.
Yeah, appreciate you having me.
Yeah, I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time. We've chatted with a number of other guys from the Whitetail Properties team. You know, good buddies with Alex Gilstrom and a number of other folks within the organization, but I've just always wanted to get to pick your brain because you just seem to be one of the most consistent, serious, big buck killers in the whole crew. So I'm glad we can finally do this, Gabe. And I guess to kind of get things started, I briefly introduced you before we jumped on here, but you've been a long time member of the Whitetail Properties team, both from the real estate side and the TV show side. But can you tell us a little bit from your own perspective about what it is you do and what this experience has been like for you?
Yeah, so I'm a sales agent for them. Simple as that. I work in South Central Iowa. I'm blessed to have grown up there, which I think goes hand in hand with the real estate and the hunting. You know, I grew up in this type of hunting environment my whole life. So when it turned into more of a business, you know, it's already something I'd lived. So very fortunate for that. But I've got, like I said, I share a territory with Derek Grimsrud. We work South Central Iowa, you know, and that's about it. Been with him since day one, kind of helped him build it up, knew about it when it was the idea on a napkin, so to speak.
Wow. It's got to be kind of amazing for you to see what it has become now, isn't it? I mean, from going to napkin stage to, you know, such a leader in the space now?
Yeah. No, it's awesome. It's grown really fast. We've got tons of, you know, really good guys on the team. And I think it's balanced. You know, we've got the right owners and the right people in the right places. You know, we're not all exactly the same. And it seems like, you know, some guys' strengths, you know, pick up for other guys' weaknesses, so to speak. And so I think it's just a great balance. Got a really smart business crew. Yeah, it's blown up. It's went really fast. And when I got in real estate, I'm not surprised by it. You know, I've been self-employed my whole life. I got out of high school and started a construction business and did that and kind of started guiding and, you know, through my 20s and, you know, loved the outdoors. And, you know, it kind of worked out because I had a bunch of guys working for me and I could leave in the fall and the winter and kind of do what I love to do as a side job, so to speak. And then the whole, you know, the whole real estate ball started rolling and I went and got my license before we were even a company and kind of got my feet wet, so to speak. You know, did a little bit of work, kind of getting my toe into the water and it just took off, you know, and really quickly I knew that, you know, with the team we had and what we were doing was, you know, I knew the sky was the limit.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, I don't know the details of it, but I believe you do own some deer hunting ground of your own. And we get a lot of questions about how to get started with that. You know, how can I get my first property, especially for guys that maybe don't have a ton of expendable income, but they want to start somewhere. I don't want to spend our whole time talking about this, but do you have any quick tips off the get-go for people that want to explore that option someday to become a property owner?
Yeah, it's like anything, you know, the big one's just that down payment that first year, you know, so you got to be able to, you know, save up some cash. You got to get yourself in the position, but, you know, at the same time, start small, you know, start out with something, you know, improve it, you know, document it, do all the little necessities, so to speak, to make it a better hunting farm. And, you know, and for the most part where I come from, land, you know, appreciates pretty well. I mean, there's some spots in the road where she went flatline, but, you know, if you get into one, do some work, give it a few years, it's going to appreciate, roll that thing into a little bit bigger and so on and so forth. I've got a lot of clients that started out with 20s and 40s and own, you know, 400, 500, 600 acre tracts now. So it's doable. You know, I got a lot of guys that got average jobs and don't have millions in the bank, so to speak, but it's like anything, if you really want to do it, if you're passionate about it, you know, you work hard at it, it'll come around.
Yeah, that's the truth to, like you said, just about anything in life. So put your mind to something, you can make it happen. So speaking of making things happen, from what I've seen from the outside, it looks like you've had a really good 2017 season. I think I saw, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I saw that you killed your biggest buck to date. Is that true?
Yeah, I got lucky this year, man. It was a good one. It was a big non-typical that we passed last year as a four-year-old, and it just all lined up, and it's a long story. Yeah, I mean, I'm more than happy to talk about it, but it lined up, and you know, we dug in on him real hard once we got him in the area of the farm we wanted him and we expected him to get into, and we just burrowed in like a tick and got him killed. It took about a week. Wow. You know, from we really got after him to kill him. It took about a week, and we played the edges, and we were smart. But, you know, we dug into that farm. I didn't go anywhere else. I had zero interest in hunting or looking at anything other than him. So we dug in, and it all worked out. Came together, you know, just an awesome hunt. Got a good pre-roll, come out, fed in the food plot, bumped some does, you know, passed, you know, a couple 45-yard shots, which I had no intention of taking, and ended up at 30, and got a good hit on him, and he didn't get out of the food plot, so it was awesome.
That is awesome. Now, I got to tell you, I like long stories. So can you give us the full detailed kind of saga of this buck, how it went from passing him last year to your plan coming into this year and how it all kind of worked out in detail?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So last year he showed up on the farm late November. I've gotten in my later years, these last few years, I'm not as good about keeping some of the pitchers I probably should. I deal with such a high volume that I'm starting to, I don't want to call it a snob, but I'm getting to where sometimes I'll maybe not save some of the stuff that I should. Well, anyways, last year we went back through, you know, when he showed up, I started digging. I couldn't place him. Knew he wasn't a five-year-old. You know, it was one of those deer I was 90% he was a four-year-old. He showed up, I'm going to say November 18th, 20th, right there, when we started getting pictures of him. Immediately decided to pass him, knew he was on the farm. He spent the rest of the year there. You know, he was there all fall, all winter after that. Never did find his sheds, and I'm not a big shed guy. You know, I don't spend a lot of time. I got other stuff I like doing in the spring, to be honest with you. So never got his shed, but he was in there all winter. We knew that. So in that part of the farm has got some really good bedding, and it's kind of known for that. Deer do gravitate. So this year, you know, he was on the radar, so, you know, but I was worried he was going to show up later in November like last year. Last year he had a nice 10-point frame, good mass, good time length, and he had a G2 and a G3 on his right side that were deep fork. Like, deep fork is in common base. I mean, they were big, deep fork, you know, so he had a couple really big split times there, and, you know, we thought, this thing could really be something cool next year. Well, this year rolls around, same gig. We didn't get any pictures of him. I didn't expect to, you know, you hope to, but we're not expecting to. We finally laid eyeballs on him, you know, doing a lot of glass, and we finally got eyeballs on him. And then once we seen him, and I'm wanting to say that was around November 1st, he was really close. And so now my wheels were turned. I'm thinking, I wonder if last year maybe, you know, he was in here earlier than I, you know, realized. Well, sure enough, we got the right wind to go check a couple cameras on the 3rd, and he'd already been in there. And so immediately, you know, once we got these new pictures, you know, we'd already seen him, so we knew what he had done. Not with detail, but we knew he was big. When I was figuring he was a 200-inch animal, you know, right at. And so once we started getting pictures of him, it was a lot easier to really start critiquing and digging and looking, and we knew he was really good. Didn't realize that he was as good as what he actually is, but we knew he was 200-plus, and so we got after it. The night we pulled the cameras and got pictures of him, the next morning, my first move, we went and jumped in a set that was on the edge of bedding. It wasn't in the thick bedding, but it was on the edge. We had the right wind. It was easy to get into. Hadn't been in that stand all year. I got him 25 yards. So my first move, it was like, you know, move the pawn up one step, and boom. He was the first deer we seen that morning.
Wow.
He come up the creek bottom, really thick stuff. And he got to a point where he made a scrape, and I thought, okay, if he keeps coming up this creek, he's going to be right in the power alley, you know, anywhere from a 20 to 40-yard shot. If he turns to his right, it's not going to be good. A, he's going to be, I mean, exactly dead downwind of us in, you know, 50 yards once he makes that direction. And two, there's just no shooting lanes there. It's all hedge and nasty, and it's just thick. And so, sure enough, he goes the wrong way. And I'm a big Ozonics guy. You know, we've ran them for years. I swear by them. I love them. Anyway, he gets to directly downwind at 35, 40 yards. He does what most all deer do when you're using them correctly, is he stops. He kind of looks over in our direction, and you can see that, you know, like always, they know something's there. He's kind of looking around, trying to feel things out. And, I thought, here's our moment of truth. And sure enough, you know, a couple seconds of sitting there looking our direction, he flickers his tail, starts walking, goes right on through. I'm like, perfect, okay.
That's such a relief when that happens, too.
Yeah, at that point, it's like, all right, we just dodged a bullet, we're good. You know, now I need him to make a move, you know, somewhere to get a shot. So he comes down this trail, and I knew at one point, if he pops out of this trail to kind of exit out of the brush and go up into the field, I knew right when he hit that other trail, that was going to be my shot, 25 yards. And so I'm at full draw long before he gets there, and I'm tippy-toeing up and down, out, and rubbing the tree. And later on, looking at the camera, it's kind of funny because I was all over trying to just find a hole, and there wasn't. and so I let him go. I wasn't about to force it. You know, this animal, I knew once he got in here, his days were probably numbered with me. So I wasn't going to push it. I wasn't going to take a chance. You know, I really wanted to get him with a bow, of course. But I wasn't going to push it. So we let him walk. And and he went right up into the main bedding, and he was headed in the same direction of all the food sources, the food plots. And I thought, I'd kill him on that food plot tonight. I know I can, but the wind was dead wrong. When I say dead wrong, like dead wrong is in, we can't even get in, you know, and that's what worries me is, you know, once I get into a blind or a stand, I'll push the limits anymore because of our scent control and ozonics. I really will. I'm pretty ballsy when it comes to making a push on a big deer, but we couldn't get in. I mean, there's just no way to even get there, you know. I mean, so, which I've walked with those onyx over my head before, but I just wasn't going to, there again, wasn't going to push. It's too early. So the next day we slip in there, wind turns around, we slip into that food plot, pull the camera 20 yards in front of the blind at like 450. I mean, tons of daylight left. They're just point blank right out in front of the ground blind. So, you know, now, you know, I know he's in my wheelhouse and I'm worried, you know, he didn't have a doe at this point, and I'm worried, you know, man, he's going to get doe here any day. It's getting, you know, it's right. He's moving a lot to find one. Well, that next morning, we didn't hunt. You know, I didn't want to push it. The wind wasn't right. And I'm big on that. I'll take my shots. I'll be patient. And I'd rather go glass something than to go force a move. And so, you know, that next morning we did a little driving around. Sure enough, he's with a doe. You know, so we basically held off. You know, at that point I knew it was going to get a little tougher because he'd gotten with a doe. And so, you know, we burrowed into the food. I thought, you know, at this point, I hope she drags into the food or he breaks loose. And, you know, they end up on this food source. So we literally dug in. I mean, dug in. We were leaving all of our equipment, all of our bows. I mean, the only thing we took out was batteries. And so we were able to get in and out of this food source, literally with deer in the field getting in, deer in the field getting out, you know, multiple days in a row without ever getting any sort of, you know, busted whatsoever.
How do you think you were able to do that? Was it just because you had planned out great access and entry routes already, yeah, or were you doing something different?
No, that was pretty consistent. I mean, when I get these big deer, I start making plans for next year, you know. And so we were lucky enough to have corn on the farm. And with corn, you know, these ground blinds, I mean, we can just walk down rows. I'll even go in with a machete, and we'll just trim back maybe one row to give us extra room. And you can get right up in the back of them blinds, you know. And it's funny because I had a new cameraman this year, and I don't think he'd ever experienced something like it. But, you know, we can get in. We can get out. You know, you wait till it's good and dark, there can be 30 deer in the field, and, you know, some of them are only 20 yards from you, and we can get out. And it's kind of funny because you get away from the blind, you start walking down the trail, and you almost start laughing because, you know, they don't have a clue. You know, it's just so I've gotten really good at that. That's a big part of the strategy. I'm huge on in and out. You know, I feel like if a lot of these big deer, if you can consistently sit on them and not booger it up, they're going to end up, you know, they're not going to be there every time, but if you can consistently get in and get out, they're going to eventually be there. And that's, you know, and that was the case with this one. I knew he would come to this food source. So we hunted a couple evenings in a row and no sight of him, no pictures of him, but we were scouting in the morning and, you know, and laying eyeballs on it. So I knew he was around. He was just with this doe. Well, the night before we killed him, which would have been November 9th, we were sitting on that food, and sure enough, same as every night, the herd comes to us. Everything's coming out to feed. Little bucks are bumping and chasing. You know, we even had a really good solid 10-pointer in the field. And sure enough, he goes out the back door, and I can see him with his doe going across just a grass hay field. He takes her the whole completely different direction. And so the next morning, I thought to myself, we got to go over there. I got to check this out. So we went over and pulled the camera. He wasn't in the food plot that night, you know, so he hadn't been in there since he hooked up with this doe. And we went over, you know, kind of where we seen him. And I thought, you know, I could probably get on this edge and hang a set real quick. And wind's right. And, you know, we could roll the dice. And I thought about it. And, you know, I like to gamble. I'm a gambler. And, you know, and so when I play blackjack, if I hit on 15, I hit every one of them all night long. I don't hit them at all. And so I literally told myself, I thought that in my head, I'm like, stay on the food. Don't chase him. He's gonna be to the food. Just stick there. This is, you know, if this is the same doe, he's going to be breaking loose anytime. So we did, you know, could have went and hung, and we didn't. Thank God we didn't, because that night we went right back in there, got in the blind, and sure enough, he popped out at, you know, 20 to 5. Had a doe just kind of bumping around. I don't think he was with her. I think he had broke loose from the other one, and this is a different deer. Worked his way out into the plot, you know, good light left, fed a little bit. Actually fed hard. You could tell he hadn't, you know, he'd been out running for a few days, fed hard, and then ended up actually bumping a doe kind of down the fence line and out of sight. And I thought, oh, no, you know, he's got it already. you know, that's the worry at this time of the year. You know, when you start getting into, you know, that part of the rut, it doesn't take these big deer very long to get back with the doe. And I thought, he's going to push her off down one of these fence lines and he's gone. Sure enough, he got lucky. He come back. You know, at this point, I had a couple 45-yard shots. I told Karen, I said, I'm not going to, you know, I want him 40 yards or in. I'm not going to push this deer. It's, I just felt too good. I felt like we're going to get him killed. And we got lucky, and he got too close. He got to 30, you know, and at that point, obviously, you know, put a good hit on him. He barely got out of the food plot, didn't even get over the fence back into the cover, and fell dead on camera. So,
wow.
That's the long of it.
That's awesome. It's a great example of playing it smart on a deer like that, taking advantage of the data points that you were able to collect, and then, you know, taking your shots at the right times. We talk about that so much, and this is just a perfect illustration of that. So, what did he end up scoring, Gabe?
226 and change.
Wow.
Yeah, so he grew. I mean, I remember in the garage, my buddies were taping him, and I remember once they got done with the tape, and one of, you know, my buddy Scott was adding him up, and I looked at him, because I was hoping he's going to be in the 90s, you know, before we started adding up fractions. I'm like, please tell me he's mid-90s, low-90s, you know, and Scott looked at me, and he goes, I'm at 214. So at that point, I knew I was in a really good, he was way bigger than we thought. And, you know, it just a tremendous, he put 50 inches on, you know, and you never know what deer, I knew this deer, you know, from looking at him, had the juice. I mean, it was obvious that he had what it would take to blow up, but, you know, he put a ton of inches on, drop times, splits, stickers all over his bases. Frame-wise, he wasn't a framey deer. He's 175-inch mainframe 10 with a 17-inch spread, 24-inch beams, but he had 50 inches of trash, you know. So when you start adding up 7, 8, 9-inch splits and 8-inch drop times, those kickers off those and triple brows on one side and little stickers on his brow. I mean, he just kept adding up. So.
Jeez. Was there anything that you took away from this experience? Any lesson learned, or was there something that was just, you know, driven home again for you? I don't know. What was your takeaway from this whole deal?
I don't know. I've hunted I've been fortunate enough to grow up, you know. I mean, where I hunt is where my dad's father homesteaded, you know. I mean, it's ground that I've grown up my whole life hunting, and I watch these deer, and I don't know. I feel like when I get my eyeballs on them, you know, and I know, and they're in the wrong spot, which is on me, I feel like I've got the tools and the knowledge that I can lay things out, set something up, and I can be patient. That's another, you know, and I'm fortunate. I'm blessed to have a situation where I don't, you know, rather than going chasing another deer around or, I got to be in a stand night because I got a week to hunt, I don't go. I'll go glass. I'll try to get some work done in the middle of the day, and we'll take our shot. So I'll be real patient, and I'll push real hard too. You know, it's just, I guess it's everything. You know, you got, every deer's different. You know, like a couple years ago, I chased around a big one that he was kind of a unique buck because every time we hunted him, we seen him, you know, and that's not very common. You know, you get these 5 and 6 year old deer that you're hunting, you know, some of them you're lucky to see them once and that's when you kill them. And others, you know, like this deer, you see them here and there and, you know, and finally you catch up to them. And then there's deer where, you know, like the unicorn buck shot a couple years ago. I mean, I bet we filmed it 15 times. You know, he was always at 80 or 100, you know, but it was cool. It was cool because we were on it and he had no idea. And that's probably what I'll take away from it, I guess. And, you know, the more I talk, think about it, is these big deer, if they don't know you're on their tail and you can consistently stay on them, it's a matter of time. And that's what I try to do. You know, I'm really, really big about scent control on my boots. I'm big on Ozonix. We've used them for years. You know, I'm into huge on setups and scenarios of getting in and getting out, you know, and I think that's the big one. When you can consistently take shots at them and not booger it, you know, eventually you're going to connect. You know, when you take that shot, like, you know, when I was younger, I might take that shot and dig in there really hard and get aggressive and blow something up. You know, it sets you back so far that, you know, it's hard to recover sometimes from. But if you can get in and out, you know, and you're on them and you know what they're doing, you know, you're going to connect it sooner or later.
Yeah. Other than the setup like you had on this food plot you were talking about where you've got the standing corn trimmed out that you can come in and out of, do you have any other tricks or things that you've done in the past to just help with that in and out? Because this is something that so many people struggle with, and it's so important, though. Anything else, you know, that you do on that front?
Everything. I mean, and it's funny because I drive around my neighborhood now, and, you know, it's funny how, you know, it just knowledge kind of grows, and, you know, and people learn and find out. But everything from planting grasses to stacking hay bales to, you know, I mean, I've even put camo netting on the bottoms of blinds so we're getting down. They can't see us getting, you know, down the ladders. And so, yeah, I use all kinds of things. Hay bales are good. I love using hay bales. You know, if I last minute kind of deal and, you know, I'll go stack some hay bales up in front of the blind just so that I know I can get out of there and not, you know, because that's really all it is. I mean, it's, you know, for the most part, these scenarios we set up, you know, if you can get down and 20 or 30 yards down the trail, you're done. You're gone, you know. And so that's the big one, just setting stuff up to where you can get out. And it usually doesn't take much, you know. I mean, if you can block visibility, let it get good and dark, you know, in some of these spots we put food so close to bedding that you can go get in at noon and there's going to be 8 or 10 deer on the field. It's just how it is. You're in the right, you know, and that's when you know you're in the right spot. When you're going in and hunting stuff that, you know, at noon, 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and there's already deer in there, you know you're doing something right. And that's where even getting in, you got to have a visual barrier to be able to slip in and slip out. And you know, and that's, you know, on this deer was everything.
Yeah, for sure. I've definitely experienced some of the same things, and I've got a 5.5-year-old buck that I've been hunting here in Michigan, and it's been similar to that unicorn buck where I'm seeing him almost every time I go in after him. You know, the first couple weeks of November when I was hunting him hard, I was seeing him all the time, but, you know, just out of range, that kind of deal. But I attributed much of that continued, you know, the fact I was still, you know, seeing him, I attributed a lot to the fact that I was able to get in and out carefully without boogering it up. I think it's just so important.
Absolutely.
So before we move on, let's take a quick second to thank our partners at Whitetail Properties.
This week with Whitetail Properties, we are joined by Tom James, a land specialist out of central Indiana. And Tom is going to be telling us about what the very first habitat improvements should be for a land manager.
Good question. Some of the first key things, the fundamentals that you want to think about is when you think in terms of what a deer requires, the food, security, cover, and water. And the QDMA has a great analogy of the thinking about the lowest hole on the bucket that you need to plug up to keep the water from leaking out. So what could be missing on your property that the surrounding land may have? And so you want to do a quick assessment. Maybe it's food, maybe it's water, maybe if you can... maybe it's cover. If you can look through your woods and see 200 yards, then you've got an issue with too much shade, not enough sunlight, creating new potential browse and cover for your deer. So maybe it's a timber either stand improvement or a harvest or a combination of two that's going to allow some more new growth to come in and thicken up your property. Maybe it's as simple as you not leaving an area alone as a sanctuary. If you're traipsing all over 40 acres and pushing deer off every time you go, then that's obviously an issue. So maybe just an adjustment in the way that you move around and hunt the property and approach things. If food is your lacking ingredient or your lowest hole in the bucket, then even in timber, it takes some work, but you can certainly clear out some openings and plant food. And I would suggest considering both perennial food and annual food, stuff that you can leave in like clover and chicory as a perennial coming back every year, and do some fall planted cereal grains and brassicas for the fall time. So you've got a year round program going on. And typically it's not an issue in the Midwest, but if water is a lacking ingredient, then maybe you can create a water hole or even some of the new systems like the Banks watering tanks that you can set up that are mobile and fill up and provide water sources for your deer so that they don't have to leave the property to water. Again, it's fairly rare, but that could be a consideration.
If you'd like to learn more and to see the properties that Tom currently has listed for sale, visit whitetailproperties.com/James. That's J-A-M-E-S.
So I want to transition a little bit now, because we've been talking about your success there in early November. People have been, you know, looking forward to November all year, and now it's came and gone in a flash. It's always shocking to me how fast it gets here and then it's done.
Yeah.
So now we're staring December in the face. From your perspective, is the best behind us, or do you like the late season? Do we have some good things still ahead for us here?
Yeah, I love late season. Anymore, I don't like November. I mean, I know I killed my two biggest deer, but killed, you know, in November. My two archery 200s are both November 10th and 12th. But when I peel them off the wall, boy, it real quickly goes to late October, late November, and later. You know, I struggle a lot in November. And so, you know, when I start getting into that 10th and 12th and I haven't gotten any killed, I almost start, you know, looking towards the 21st and on, because we really struggle, you know, with these bigger deer once they start locking down with those. And so, yeah, I love late season. I'm a, you know, I don't farm actively right now, but I've grown up farming, you know, and so we've got equipment, we're fortunate, we got a lot of food, and so I love late season. You know, I would rather give deer a place to live and hunt them on the edges and hunt them on food. That's, you know, probably, you know, one, you know, you put that together with entrance and exit, and I think you got it picked at that point. You know, I think you got it made. And so, you know, with late season coming up, you've got good food sources, good grain. I'm a big grain guy when it gets late. I'd rather have corn and beans. You know, when you get to that late season hunt and you got good food and you can get in and out, it's as deadly as any part of the year, in my opinion.
Yeah. So if someone, you know, right now, it's today's the last day of November, so we're just starting to make that transition into December, into that late season kind of phase of the year. Is there anything that should be done or that people should be thinking about or even actually physically doing right now to prepare for this late season? Or would you say, you know, just get out and start hunting food? Or I don't know, is there any kind of transitionary things they should be doing right now to get ready for that best late cold weather and hunts?
No, and I would say, you know, if you've got to do something, you're behind the eight ball. I think it all's got to be done ahead of time. You've got to kind of prepare and have your stuff set up. Because at this point, I just lock down everything. I keep everything to a minimum. And I really watch my cameras. You know, we'll run a bunch of cameras. You know, they start coming back to the scrapes real hard once the rut winds down. It seems like the signpost kind of, you know, so you can run some cameras back on them scrapes and a lot of food source stuff, a lot of time lapse. You know, I run a lot of time lapse cameras so I can see the whole food plot before the sun goes down. And so that's what I'm doing, you know. And that's the other thing. You know, a lot of these food plots, I may have them set up to where, you know, they are tight to the bedding, you know, which is when you get those deer in there real early, you know, because I've killed a lot of, here in the last few years, I've killed a lot of deer at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, 5, 6, 7 year olds. And heck, 2 years ago, I killed a 9.5 year old and it was like 3:15, you know, so, wow. But that's kind of getting back into that, you know, the food's where it needs to be. It's close to the bedding. They don't have to move very far to get to it. But then I've also got that, you know, component of if I'm going to put some food here, you know, how can I monitor it? How can I check it? Well, you know, that's kind of like the blind deal. I try to set it up to where, you know, as long as I get the right wind, I can get in there, pull some cards, get out midday or late morning, you know, and not have any issues. You know, we're big on vehicles too. You know, I'd much rather pull in somewhere like a farmer would, you know, just in case something is on the food, you know, in the middle of the day. I'd rather pull in there and, you know, sometimes I'll even take the tractor in, you know, just because they're used to it and it doesn't bother them as much, you know. But I'd much rather, you know, take a risk with a vehicle or a tractor than, you know, walking up a hill and blowing out a field, you know, on foot. So yeah. A lot of things.
with the trail cameras, you were talking about, you know, monitoring these and you talked about using vehicles to access it and things like that. How often do you go in to check these cameras? Because that's always something I struggle with is, to your point earlier, you want to keep everything, all your impact as minimal as possible. But at the same time, you need to monitor these somehow so that you can make sure you're hunting at the right time. So how do you balance that?
You know, if the wind's right and I'm cautious, I'm not going into their bedroom to get these. And so I don't worry about that as much. Now, with that said, I'm not checking them every day. But I don't worry about it too much. I'm really careful with my feet. You know, I'll really take care of my boots. But if the wind's right and I'm not leaving a bunch of boot tracks, which I'm there again, that's kind of one of my deals. I really watch my foot tracks. It doesn't bother me too much. You know, I'll slip in, slip out. You know, I think deer expect a certain amount of pressure. I think that they live with the next amount of pressure. And I think that's a pressure that doesn't bother them. You know, you're not going into their bedroom, you're not bumping them out of bed, you're not, you know, as long as you're not blowing wind right down into a draw or a ditch or a block of woods they're in, you know, and you're careful, and that's your feet. I'm big on feet. You know, I don't think it really hurts me too much, you know. So, you know, if I know there's a good one in there and I'm really monitoring, I mean, I may check the camera, you know, like that big one this year, we were checking that camera every couple of days, you know, but we got in, got out, you know, we didn't do it when the wind was wrong, but if we had the right wind, we'd go, we'd flip in, flip out, check it, you know, and make a decision from there.
Yeah. Do you do any other scouting of any kind at this time of year, maybe glassing or literally walking around at all? Anything else other than the cameras?
Yeah, glass. I'm a big glasser. I've got all kinds of places. Most of my farms, you know, they're tough, but, you know, we've got advantage points, you know, that we can go park and just glass and sit and watch. And, you know, and I like doing that because I can cover a lot more ground. Growing up, my father was big, you know, that was one of the things we did. You know, we covered a lot of ground. We had a lot of ground to hunt growing up, you know, and so rather than being stuck or confined to one spot, you know, we could bounce around and cover multiple farms and look at stuff. And, you know, a lot of the deer I kill, I mean, that's kind of where it'll start, you know, a lot of times is I'll pick them up from glassing or scouting. You know, I'll have their picture, but when you can lay eyeballs on and watch them for 10 minutes, you know, making natural movement, you know, then you can really start to, you know, connect the dots at that point. And so a lot of the deer I shoot, you know, that's a big part of it is glassing, scouting from the road, pulling into high points, you know, anywhere you can get away with it.
So would it be fair to say that you are doing that more often than maybe you're even hunting during the late season?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My cameramans love me. they love me, you know, because I'm not the guy that's going to just pound it out for seven straight days. I mean, I may hunt one day in seven, you know, if that's, you know, because I'm not big on blind hunting. I don't like to just go, oh, let's go in here, the wind's right. You know, I like scenarios. I like to know big deer in there. I like to have a game plan. That's what gets me fired up anymore, you know. And so when I can really start, you know, I like going into a set because I've got a whole bunch of data getting me there. I don't like going and just setting all day in a set somewhere to say I'm hunting. You know, I would rather go pick them points apart and start putting them together and be really fired up going in somewhere because I know he's either there or close or he's been there, you know. And so, yeah, I do tons of scouting. I would, you know, this year we weren't hunting mornings much at all because I didn't want to go take the chance. I knew I had his kitchen. You know, I could hunt him in the bedroom, but I knew I had the food. I knew that we could get in and out super, super easy. It was like a dream setup for in and out. And so I just, you know, mornings we took a couple shots, seen him once, you know, about killed him that first move I made on him. But, you know, in the mornings I'd go run around the sections and park and watch and just see if I could put eyeballs on him. And we did, you know, we seen him quite a bit.
Yeah. So in the late season then, what has to be present as far as conditions or data for you to take that shot?
Like right now I'm struggling with after that deer. I've got a handful of 5-year-olds that didn't grow much. And so I'm really struggling with even, I'm rolling the dice on maybe all of them, but one for letting them go another year to see what happens. But you know, with like that one deer, I want to get a beat on where he's at, right? You know, I know where he likes to bed. I know kind of where his home is. But I want to get him in on that food plot. I want to see him on camera. I'd like to see him in daylight, you know, whether it's scouting that food plot from a distance or slipping in and pulling a card. But yeah, I won't, you know, I talked to Adam, my cameraman, just earlier today, and he asked me what's going on. I said, absolutely nothing. There won't be. The weather's warm. I said, once it cools off, I said, I'm going to keep watching cameras. I'm going to keep scouting. And once I really get one, you know, once you know one's in there, then I'll get after it. But if I don't know there's one in there, I'll leave it alone, you know. And so between cameras or glassing, you know, a field, I'll sit back rather than take a shot and go up in there and, you know, just on a whim and you know, maybe something happens and booger it up and, you know, and set yourself back.
Mm-hmm. So would you not even go in if we got a great set of conditions? So let's say you haven't gotten eyes on them, you know, recently in daylight or something like that, but we just get this mega cold front and snow. Will something like that dream scenario be enough to get you to go in there, even though you don't have the sighting or the picture to tell you to go? Or is it, no, I got to have that?
Yeah, in that scenario, I will. If you get a, you know, that big cold push coming down, big front, cold temperature, snow, you know, the perfect storm everybody wants and looks for, you bet. I'll roll the dice on those. Average conditions, no. I'll just sit back. I'll wait, you know. I've killed a lot of deer in average conditions because, there again, I went, pulled the card or glass the field, and wow, he's in there, you know, 45 minutes before dark. And then, you know, the next night get in there on very fair, you know, conditions that are fair at best, you know, warm or windy, whatever, and get him killed. But yeah, if I get that perfect storm of big front moving in, cold temps, some snow combined, yeah, then what I do is if I don't have one really, you know, a bead on one, then I just use my gut of, okay, I'm pretty sure this is where he's going to be. This is where he's always been. This is where he likes to be this time of the year. And then I'll take my shot, you know, at that point. So weather will get me on a food source, even without, you know, getting some sort of data knowing they're in there.
Yeah. Do you pay attention at all to things like an annual pattern? Like if you saw a certain buck, you know, show up in daylight last year on December 15th and 17th and 18th, would you think about that this year and say, hey, I think it's likely that he might start showing up around the same time frame? Do you pay attention to anything like that?
Oh, all of it. Absolutely. The moon, the pressure, recent, you know, because I've had deer, like I said, I mean, like that 9.5-year-old, like, yeah, he may have been 10.5. We had pictures of him from either 2 to 9 or from 3 to 10. So, jeez, you know, it's kind of at that point, it's, you know, it's 9 or 10-year-old. But like that deer, you know, once we did get him killed and we seen him the year before we killed him for the first time. But yeah, you know, once I look back at him, I mean, his patterns spring and summer and fall and winter were the same for 8 years, you know. And so, yeah, I hunt a lot of deer that way where, you know, if they do something 1 year at a certain time frame, there's a good chance that, you know, they'll do the same thing in a similar time frame the following year. And a lot of that has to do with bedding too. You know, on my farm, we've got river bottom, you know, which is always early season. That's where they're at. You know, you can about bank on it. And then I've got these, you know, wintering farms or, you know, areas where they just transition, you know. And so, you know, year after year, I've learned that, you know, if there's deer on this bottom, and when they start looking for that warm spot on the hill, they're going to be right up here, you know. And so, you know, a lot of that weather will dictate that. But then also, like you said, you know, 4-year-old, 1 year, you know, he's up here, you know, feeding, doing whatever. Following year, it's funny how more often than not, about the same time, they'll do the same thing.
Yeah. So another thing that I've personally been trying to look at, kind of similar to this, see if I can identify a pattern with this buck that I keep mentioning that I've been trying to figure out. I've started to wonder, you know, does he show up in a certain food source or in a certain area with a given wind direction and try to correlate that and so on. So no, okay, when there's a southwest wind, it's probably my best chance that he'll be on the south side of the farm with a southwest wind, but then when I got the northwest wind, then it's most likely he's going to be over here. Do you see common movement with a common wind direction over the years with any of these deer too?
I don't. That one I would say no. You know, I that one I've not dug in that deep. Sometimes, you know, and this isn't, I mean, I'm not, sometimes I think we give him too much credit, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I do, you know, I really do. And I mean, I sometimes listen to people and kind of their theories and stories, and it's like, sometimes you got to remember they're an animal of habit, you know. And so are there some bucks out there that get just so ridiculously smart they don't move unless the wind's? Yeah, I'm sure there are, but, you know, I'm fortunate enough there again to be in an area where deer aren't pressured. We keep the pressure low. I don't see that. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's not something that I've taken note of over the years and thought, you know, wow, this buck's, I mean, with a north wind, he's going to go off this side, and with a south wind, he's going to go off this, you know. That's one I really haven't dealt with personally.
Yeah, I think your point about sometimes we take it too far, I think there's something to be said about that. I think you can get, and I'm guilty of this because I'm such a data-driven guy. I want to analyze things so much, but sometimes you can get that paralysis by analysis, I think.
Yeah.
And that's, you got to walk this fine line between being smart about it and making informed decisions, but at the same time not just going overboard. So that's tricky.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And it's all calculated. It's just sometimes you can get caught up and give them a little bit too much credit. You know,
yeah.
I feel like that happens a lot anymore, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I talked a lot. You know, you got to remember, they're a creature of habit. They don't reason, you know. I mean, they're going to do things, you know, to survive. And they sometimes I think we take it to a level probably a little overboard.
All right, guys, real quick, this is our final break of the day, but I want to take a second here to tell you about a deal from our friends at Huntera Maps. From now through December 6th, 2017, they've got a special holiday sale offering 20% off any product, any of their maps on there. You got to check it out between now and December 6th. You don't need a promo code or a coupon or anything. But, man, if you are looking for something to put on your own list, this is a great opportunity to nudge your significant other or family member and say, hey, hurry up and get this deal. Or if you have somebody on your list that you need to buy for, a Huntera map makes a great gift. I just end up using these so often in my own personal life, whether it's, you know, standing in my office with my buddies, staring at my maps on the wall and talking through strategy, or, you know, maybe when I'm in my truck with my buddy Furter at our Ohio property, we got our field map laid out in the console and we're planning out which stands to hunt that day. It's just really nice to have something as high quality and tangible as this. So if you're interested, head over to Huntera.com. That's Huntera.com and get 20% off from now through December 6th. So what about this scenario then? Let's say you've got a handful of different types of food sources on your property in the late season. Maybe you got a grain field somewhere. Maybe that's corn or beans. And then maybe you've got a green food source. Maybe it's brassicas or something like that. And who knows what else. Maybe then there's a natural forage area. Maybe there's still some acorns or something along those lines in another section of your farm. I find myself in this dilemma. I'm going to go into a late season hunt. Conditions seem good. And I'm like, okay, which food source should I focus on? Because so much late season hunting is focused on food. How do you choose the right food? Is there any set of conditions that you say, okay, now I'm going to focus on green. Now I'm going to focus on grain. Now I'm going to do something different. How do you think about that?
That's easy. Corn is king. That is easy. I've always lived by corn. And here's why. Late season, you know, you get your guys that are diehard bean guys, and I always laugh and say, you better hope my corn plot ain't across the fence or across the road from you, because I'm going to own them. And I truly believe that. I think beans are great. I think they've got their place. I think they're an awesome food source for a longer time frame. You know, it's like alfalfa. I think alfalfa is probably the one. I've taken it off my farm and I'm putting it back on my farm. And I think alfalfa is, you know, if you want to hold deer, is one of the most important, you know, components. I think beans have an awesome place. But when you get right down to late season hunting and what they really need, it's corn. You know, they're going to come to it. You know, if you've got a food plot that's half corn, half beans, I'm not saying they're going to go all, you know, but that corn's going to own the majority of them. And I think, with consistency, there's going to be some nicer. Yeah, they're going to hit. You're going to see deer in the beans a little more than the corn. But I think consistently, day in, day out, when you're hunting, you know, in our region where you're snow and cold and there's survival mode, corn's game.
Do you have any green food sources like turnips, brassicas, rape, kale, all that kind of stuff? Does that do much for you?
Yeah, we use them, and I think there's some, you know, like post-rut, like right now, you know, first gun season for us, early December, I think it's phenomenal, you know, because it's the last green. Everything else has been turned, and, you know, if you've got some green and everything else is already turned, yeah, you're in the chips. And so that's where, you know, a lot of these different, you know, food sources have their spots, and, you know, and I'll hunt them, and I love them. But when you start talking consistently, day in, day out, corn is king.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to beat that. Now, how about we're actually out there hunting now? Well, I'm kind of curious about your actual stand setups for the late season. Are you hunting on tree stands, or are you just doing ground blinds or box blinds? Or if you are in a tree stand, you know, I'd be interested in the details of how you make a tree stand setup work in the late season, given, you know, some of the challenges with cover and stuff like that too. What's your take on that?
The only time I hunt stands late is if it's the only option, you know, whether it's topography or there's a deer somewhere you didn't expect and there's just no way you want to risk putting a blind in there. But that there again, you know, I feel like I prepare well enough that really doesn't happen very often. It's been quite a while. But, no, we're typically hunting, you know, some sort of a blind. We're either in a banks, we're in a, you know, a hay bale blind, ground blind. But, you know, I'd say my go-tos for the most part are my banks blinds and hay bale blinds. You know, I live in cattle country. They're used to hay bales. I mean, we get, and they're roomy. We like them. You know, they work out really well. Once in a while, we'll run a pop-up just quick and easy, you know. But I like my banks blinds. They're pretty tough to beat when snow's on the ground and it's in the teens for highs.
Yeah, a little more comfortable, too.
Yeah, office chairs are nice.
Yeah. My dad, whenever he uses one of my box blinds, he always brings his little Mr. Heat, Mr. Buddy heater in there too. You can get real luxurious.
Yeah, if I'm in the right spot, I'll do it. We do it too, you know. But if we're flirting at the edge, we'll hold off on that. But if we're in one of our spots, it's bulletproof, and you know, we don't have any worries. And yeah, we'll fire up the heater.
Yep. Now, when you're in a blind like that, or maybe your hay bale blind, you talked about how much you use Ozonics, which I do too. How do you set up your Ozonics in that situation to still maintain that that stream of scent elimination of sorts?
Well, I mean, we just mount them, you know. It's like, it's you know, figure out where your wind's at and get them mounted. You know, with blinds, like a hay bale or ground blind, or even, you know, like a tower blind, a Banks that's got, you know, like ours have vent holes, you know, if you can venturi or force your wind through one spot and wash it, and so a lot of times, yeah, we'll leave, you know, part of the door on a zip or not, you know, completely shut, or we'll crack a window, or in the Banks blinds, we'll put our Ozonics right over that vent hole to where, you know, you're really, really doing it. You know, you're washing your scent, so to speak, in the best way possible, because you're forcing everything down to a tight little spot, and then you're putting that Ozonics right on top of it. So, you know, in the Banks blinds, I'll just walk it. When I get up in there on the platform, I'll just put one up on the roof once I know where the wind's at. A lot of times we'll open a window, mount one to the window, and then shut it, you know, so that it's blowing. And then same way with, like, our hay bales, you know, I'll just screw the same tree attachment, you know, I'll just screw it right into the wall on the outside once I know where the wind's at, and turn it on turbo. And so it's just about wherever your wind's going, just, you know, what I've always told people and the doubters is it's more of a washing mechanism. It's not, you don't want blowing on you and smelling you. You want wherever your wind's going, you want it going right through that ozone, you know, and so we just set it up accordingly.
Yeah. Do you have a specifically made mount to use with a box blind like that, or do you make something custom?
No, I just put on the roof. And if it's slick or something, you know, then I improvise. I mean, earlier this year I took a, you know, I always carry tape, you know, in my backpack, and I literally just took a piece of Gorilla tape, you know, and rolled it over, stuck it on the bottom, and just, you know, and then it just stuck to the top. Now on the windows, they do make that mount where it'll clip onto the windows, which is, I think it's actually designed for your pull in a pop-up blind, and your, you know, in the pop-ups, they've got that one mount. That same mount will hook right on the window bracket of them Banks, and they'll just hook right in and hang, you know. So, and I've even went extreme before and just screwed a hole right into the side of the blind, you know. if that's what it takes, and I'm on a big one, then I'm going to screw a hole in the side of my blind. I'm fine with that. Yeah. So we just find a way to make it work, I guess, is the big one. You know, it's like a trail camera. It's awesome if you got a, you know, a trail pod, or you got some sort of mechanism to, you know, get it all perfect. You know, there's a lot of times I don't have that. I'm using Twix, Stigs, and, you know, it just whatever you can get to get it where you need it. And that's kind of the same way with the Ozonics. Once I figure out what my wind is, I just, you know, try to get it up above us and downwind.
Yeah, do what you got to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. So is there anything else on the late season front that we haven't talked about? Is there anything you're doing at this time of year or throughout the end of the season that has led to success for you that we haven't talked about?
No, I mean, it's basically food and, you know, evening hunts, very, very, very rarely morning. And I mean, I can't even remember the last time. It's been years, you know, but mainly it's, you know, take your shots. You know, add up all the data, take your shots when you feel good, hunt the weather, you know, don't get busted. I mean, that's, you know, good food. That's the key, you know, and that's tough. I mean, not everybody's got the availability to, you know, get, you know, the food needed, you know, on farms. And they're getting a portion up that I do. And we got tractors and planters. And if I want to plant 10 acres of standing corn somewhere, I go plant 10 acres of standing corn. And, you know, at that point, I know it's going to make it through season, and then we run the combine through it when it's over. So, yeah. You know, it makes it, you know, so that's the big one, you know, basically taking your shots. And if you don't have food, you don't have deer, you know, around my area. So you got to have food, you know, and anymore, everybody seems like, you know, food's becoming more prevalent, you know, so you want to hold your deer. You know, if you run out of food, your neighbors are going to be holding your deer, you know, so you're just trying to get them through season with enough food on your farm. They ain't looking somewhere else.
Yeah, that's the trick. That is the trick, yep. For sure.
Absolutely.
Well, I guess, you know, here's one final thing that we hadn't mentioned, which is just getting a shot off in the late season when you're wearing more clothing or it's just colder. Is that something you think about when it comes to whether you're still bow hunting or using a firearm? Is there anything special you think about when it comes to that moment of truth here in the later part of the year as conditions and just your what you're actually wearing out there might be different?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm bow hunting, absolutely. You know, I'm a big fan of heater body suits. You know, if I'm bow hunting late season, I don't like shooting really bulky. I'm not one of those guys that can do it. I don't like to do it. You know, so yeah, at that point, if I'm bow hunting late season, you know, I'd much rather be in a heater body suit with light layers underneath so that, you know, I feel normal shooting my bow. You know, that'd be the big one. If I'm gun hunting, nah, not worried about it at all. I can be as bulky and heavy as I want to be, and it doesn't affect me. But with the bow, I like to get in that heater body suit and try to keep, you know, my layers to a minimum so I'm not all bound up.
Yeah. You know, another thing I've always recommended to folks too is, you know, regardless of what you're wearing, when you get up into your tree or your blind or wherever you're at, make sure you just test it out. So make sure you draw back and feel how it's going to feel and make sure nothing's bunching up, you know, unexpectedly that you know, if you hadn't practiced through that routine wearing your late season gear, you wouldn't have noticed that, oh man, I got all this huge bunch up on my left arm that maybe would mess up with your cables or something. So it's good just to practice, make sure that's happening okay.
And then
I don't know if this is something you ever do, but I find myself on those really cold days that if you're sitting there for 3-4 hours in the evening maybe and it's 7 degrees or 10 degrees or something, you kind of stiffen up a little bit. So if you find yourself where there's for sure no deer in sight, and of course that's not always a given, but if you can find yourself a little second where you can just draw that bow back just to warm yourself up and stretch those muscles out, sometimes that's a good thing to do too.
Yeah, I've even climbed up and down the stand once because I was beyond the point of worried about my bow. I was in freeze mode, you know. So I've even, yeah, you know, if you look around and you feel comfortable and it's early, I've even climbed down the tree and back. I mean, that'll get you warmed up in a hurry. So especially when you're in a 25 or 30 foot tree stand like most of mine are, you go down and up once, you're usually warmed up for a while.
Yeah, and taking that little risk of going up and down, that's better than having to leave completely, right? And completely giving up on
that. I'd rather do that than sit there and, like you said, stove up and make a bad shot or, you know, not be able to get your bow back or, you know, whatever. But yeah, I'd rather take that chance and be able to sit there for another hour than to, you know, not be able to get my bow anchored back right or be stoved up and leave type of deal. So.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Gabe, I'm going to try to take some of the things we've been talking about today and put them into action actually right now. I'm down in Ohio for the last couple days of their firearm season, so I'm going to wrap this up and try to kill a very late November buck. But for anyone out there who's heard this conversation and wants to get in touch with you about land or anything else, you know, where can they learn more about what you've got going on or possibly get in touch with you?
Well, they can obviously give me a call. I mean, our website, you know, whitetailproperties.com is going to have about everything you could ask for, contact territories, you know, regions, states, all that, you know, is going to be on there for information. But email, text, phone call, if somebody specifically wants to talk to me about something in my area in Iowa, you know, I keep an eye on all those. And so phone call, text, or email can get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, Gabe, we really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to do this with us, and thank you so much, and good luck through the rest of the season.
Yep, no, I appreciate it. Good luck to you, and hopefully your Ohio works out for you.
I got my fingers crossed.
Right on.
And that will do it for us today. Thank you guys for tuning into this one. Couple quick things before we go. First off, I just want to thank everyone who's left a rating or review for us on iTunes. We have more than 1,000 five-star reviews. That's crazy. You know, we're definitely one of the highest rated hunting podcasts out there, and it's all because of you guys. So big, big thank you. If you haven't left a rating or review yet, and if you'd like to, you just need to head over to iTunes on your phone or computer. And, you know, it just takes a couple quick seconds to leave a few thoughts or just click the stars. We appreciate that. Also, we want to give a big thank you to our partners who help make all this possible. So big thanks to Sitka Gear Yeti Coolers, Matthews Archery, Maven Optics, Whitetail Institute of North America, Trophy Ridge, and Huntera Maps. And finally, thank you again to everyone out there listening, taking time out of your day to spend with us. Man, that means a lot. We appreciate it. So if you're still hunting, which I hope you are, I'm wishing you all the luck in the world. And until next time, stay wired to hunt.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.
Outdoor Adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.